Welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast series by Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank, which is holding a series of exceptional live recording sessions to cover our analysis on the economic consequences of the war in Ukraine as it is unfolding. This time, we are having our conversation recording from Twitter Spaces to discuss about the most recent announcement of the EU to ban Russian coal. I'm here with our senior fellow Simone Tagliapietra, who is joining us from Rome. Hi Simone, how are you?
Hello Giuseppe, hello, all good, thanks. Hope the same for you, hello.
Thank you. As we want this to be an interactive conversation, after setting the scene with Simone, we will invite some of you joining us here on Space to ask questions and comment. So, to recap the topic we are going to discuss today. The EU plans to ban coal imports from Russia. The move, aimed squarely at energy imports for the first time, comes as a direct response to reports that Russian forces committed war crimes in Ukraine. The coal provision was added at the last minute to a package that was set to be debated this week by EU ambassadors. The Commission also wants to block most Russian trucks and ships from entering the bloc and sanction additional industries and individuals such as Vladimir Putin's daughters. Germany, which has previously resisted efforts to embargo Russia energy, is now ready to consider phasing out coal and is discussing the exact timing with the EU. The bloc is coordinated with the United States and the group of seven countries on the measures, and the Commission is already working on additional sanctions, including on oil. Simone, can you help us understanding, firstly, how the coal ban will presumably be implemented, and what does it mean in terms of direct and indirect consequences?
So, thank you, Giuseppe. The move of the European Commission is important because it breaks the sanctions energy taboo we have been seeing so far. So it is the first time that we actually take a step further into the energy field as far as the sanctions on Russia are concerned. That's important from that standpoint. And it signals that the EU is now willing, given what we keep seeing in Ukraine, and the atrocities that are being perpetrated there by the Russians, that we are willing to put energy on the table. Of course, we start with the low-hanging fruit. We start with coal, which is, at the end of the day, not such a big deal. I mean, between the three fossil fuels we import from Russia, of course, coal is the easiest to be replaced because coal just is a simple commodity. I mean, if you don't get the coal from Russia, we will, in a matter of a couple of months, fully readjust our imports without major disruptions of our supply chains from other countries in the world that do have today's spare capacity of coal. Of course, the global coal market is also a little bit tight, so there are already implications in terms of price, but this is not something so significant. We need to put things into perspective here, I think. Every day we pay Russia around 15 million euros to get coal, while we pay them 850 million euros every day to get oil and gas. So that gives you the idea that this is the first step, and it's the, let's say, the easiest one to take. And that's, of course, not sufficient.
On this, Simone, you pointed out coal seems to be an easy one. So you basically are pointing out the purely symbolical value of this measure, like some sort of warning that things can escalate into others, or do you think that there is an actual impact of coal as such in the Russian economy? Is this going to damage the Russian economy?
No, this is not going to damage the Russian economy because, I mean, the numbers I just mentioned tell you how little revenues Russia is making out of the coal exports. If you want to eat Russia, if you want to eat Putin, you need to strike on the oil and gas. That's where the revenues are being done. And that is something we need to do quickly, in my view. And we can discuss how to do that, because we do not necessarily need a full embargo for that.
Yeah, but indeed, I mean, that's my follow-up question, because we've seen temporary resistance from some member states, including Germany, on the oil ban. And now we are seeing more and more strong voices, for example, here in Brussels, Manfred Weber, who is German and is the head of the European People's Party, let's say not the most radical politicians that we have in the spectrum of the European Parliament, but he has been raising the voice that it is of utmost importance to ban oil imports. So which are the steps to get there, and what is your analysis of what is going on at the moment on that front?
Well, on this, I would say, first of all, that momentum is building. Up to a few weeks ago, it was indeed extremely difficult to talk energy sanctions, not only in Berlin, but in several other capitals. But as this war gets more brutal, and as all what we are seeing every day continues and escalates, I think governments are rapidly moving towards the idea that we need to do something. I mean, sending almost 1 billion per day to get this oil and gas to Russia, I mean, is something we cannot afford to do. And I think this is what, for example, Borrell said yesterday as well, von der Leyen said yesterday. I mean, now many of our leaders are telling this very clearly. And as you say rightly, in the European Parliament, there is also a big support to move in this direction. Now, the question is how to do that. In my view, and that's also something that, by the way, I've been writing about with Guntram Wolf and also Axel Oxenfeld in Cologne, and we will have a little piece in Nature published next week on this issue. We don't think it's necessary to go immediately for a full embargo. I think the strategic aim that Europe wants now to achieve is to limit Putin energy rent, while ideally maintaining the flows, so to minimize the impact on the European economy. And the way to do that could be to basically put a tariff on the imports of Russian oil and gas, so to diminish immediately the Russian energy rent while maintaining the flows going. Now, this idea of the tariff works because of the inelasticity of the Russian oil and gas supplies. To be very simple, there is nowhere that Russia can send this stuff if not to Europe. That is crystal clear for natural gas, because Europe is 75% of the exports of gas of Russia, and that's mainly more than 90% via pipeline. So they simply don't have the pipelines to send the molecules to China or elsewhere, so they are stuck to the European market, let's say. And also for oil, it's difficult for them to diversify away for a number of reasons: bottlenecks in the domestic oil infrastructure within Russia, the port capacity, the capacity to find the ships to send the oil to Asia, and also the fact that crude oil has different qualities, and the Chinese refineries, for example, may not be able to treat the Urals oil. And by the way, the Chinese are not buying that much of Russian oil these days. I mean, there is also a big deal of self-sanctioning going on in the oil market for Russian oil. So basically, this is all to say that Russia is not in such, a brilliant situation as far as energy exports is concerned. They are more vulnerable than what we think. And given this inelasticity of their energy supply, we can go ahead with this tariff idea.
But Simone, let's stay a little bit more on the oil story. So obviously what you are proposing is not to go full into an oil, complete oil embargo. I understand exactly the reasons why, and I think our listeners understands the reasons why. Your proposal for a tariff, once again, I mean, sorry if I repeat myself, but basically the question is, how much such a measure would damage the Russian economy So that's the first part of my question. And then there is a second part of the question related to how do we get there and how, Europe can equip in order to have alternative to Russian oil. So if you can explain as well which are the alternatives which are at the moment being explored, and also if there is any signals from the other like-minded nations, especially the United States, to make some significant steps towards easing Europe's position when it comes to the oil situation.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that we need, first of all, to consider that even if we are to put a full embargo on Russia tomorrow, we will not see immediately the effects, in the sense that it will take time, it will take several months to really, hit the Russian economy with that, because, of course, they still have some reserves they can use, etc. So it will take time. So that's very important. We need to put in place sanctions that will remain there for possibly a very long time. And that's why possibly starting with the tariff could be the good idea, also from a game theory perspective, because if we start introducing a tariff, let's say at 20%, we can then increase this tariff over time if the situation in Ukraine continues to escalate. So that we can gain a sort of bargaining chip and continue to have leverage and potentially exercise pressure on Russia over time. This time dimension is very important because this is a sort of strategic interaction. But of course, as we do that and as we progressively eat more their economy also on the energy side, it is very important for Europe to enhance its own strategic position. And to do that, we have one way, which is to diversify away from Russia as quickly as possible. And of course, there are different ways to do that. Of course, this is going to be super challenging for Europe because we heavily are dependent on Russian gas, 40%, and oil, 25% of our demand. To do that, we need to, first of all, diminish our demand for oil and gas. So that's very important to put in place energy conservation measures, energy savings, in order to simply consume less oil and less gas. We have been estimating that, for example, if we turn down our thermostats in winter by 1-2 degrees without compromising our comfort, we can spare 10 billion cubic meters of natural gas demand, which is equal to the amount of gas we currently import from Azerbaijan to provide an idea through the transatlantic pipeline. So it's not small. If we, incentivize public transport, as many governments are now trying to do in Europe, we can spare a significant amount of oil. So doing this kind of stuff is important on the demand side. Then we need to find alternative suppliers. Alternative suppliers means for gas going LNG, and that's why the recent announcement of the US-EU pact on LNG was pretty important. For oil, it means getting more supply from the countries that have spare capacity, namely the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia. Possibly something can come from Iran or Venezuela. And that's very important to have international coordination. So working also with the United States to secure additional supplies of oil into the global market is very important. We have seen the release of some of the strategic reserves by the United States itself to lower the price last week. So all these international action is important to maintain the oil market globally liquid, which is something that will be challenging for the world. Because, of course, Russia is the first exporter of oil and this the first exporter of natural gas in the world. So this significant challenge requires an internationally coordinated effort, and Europe alone cannot do it. I mean, we need to do that in coordination with the United States, other partners also in Asia, Japan, South Korea, etc.
I will interrupt you for a second here for a last, let's say, in this to complete this overview. A last element of this triplet. I mean, you already mentioned natural gas. You put it quite often your reply when we discussed about oil, and you discussed about oil and natural gas. But I think that it will be very important once again to make a distinction here about these two sources of energy. And perhaps, you've been already writing quite a lot about the issue of gas for Bruegel together with the other of our colleagues over there. It will be once again important to be very precise and outline, highlight what is the difference between the issue of the oil and the issue of the gas, because that's very important not to lose that in the horizon when we discuss about these two issues, which are connected, of course, but they are also with significant differences.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you're right. I mean, first of all, Europe, of course, is heavily reliant on the imports of fossil fuels in general, because we import more than 90% of these fossil fuels we need. But of course, they are characterized by different degrees of difficulties in terms of substituting them, right? So coal is, of course, the easiest because, as we have said, it's a fungible good, it's a fungible commodity, you can easily transport it around, and we will easily replace the coal we will not be importing from Russia. Oil is certainly more difficult than coal, but again, if the countries with the spare capacity start to produce more, the global oil market can be maintained liquid. And again, oil is a global commodity. We can easily get the oil we need to replace the Russian volume. Gas is more difficult. It is more difficult because of one element: the rigidity of the infrastructure. Europe predominantly imports gas via pipeline, and predominantly via the pipelines connecting, of course, Europe to Russia. And that's where the problem is, that replacing this gas is difficult because it will take a long time to build new infrastructures, new pipelines to potentially new suppliers. So, for example, in the Middle East, the Caspian, the Eastern Mediterranean, etc. So what we need to do is to work on the supply side with limited options available. So we need to increase LNG imports. But the problem is that the LNG market globally is extremely tight because Asia also consumes a lot of LNG. So we will see a scramble in the global market to get these LNG cargoes that now are super expensive. And then we need to make sure to import as much as possible from the other pipeline suppliers of Europe, like Norway, Algeria, Libya, Azerbaijan. But the problem is that these countries are already either working at full capacity, like Norway can only increase very little its production, or have technical difficulties to scale up the production, like Algeria. And that's where we need to increase our energy cooperation, also to allow this country now to produce more, since we have spare capacity in the pipeline that are connecting, for example, Algeria to Italy and to Spain. So we have the pipes, we don't have the gas, we need to help them produce more to send more. But then, of course, just to conclude, these supply measures are way not sufficient to replace the Russian gas. So if, to be clear, there is an interruption tomorrow, substituting the volumes of Russian gas with other gas is not going to be sufficient because the LNG alone cannot make it, but by far. So what we need to do is a portfolio of options, starting with, for example, gas to coal switching in power generation. That's it. We need to reopen the coal-fired power plant that are currently sitting idle and produce electricity with coal rather than gas. That's the emergency plan of Italy, for example, but also of Germany and other countries. We need to keep our nuclear power plants running for longer, so we need to postpone the phase out. We need to increase the amount of renewables, heat pumps, whatever we can do in order to try to also tap into the green solutions, but that of course will take more time. Otherwise, the last resort option is to curtail industrial gas demand, which basically means very limited, administratively organized sort of energy lockdowns for certain energy intensive industries, which will of course come at a significant economic cost.
At a high cost, which would mean a recession for sure, you know. So the situation, Simona, that you paint, in any case, is not, of course, very rosy, as to say, to be mild for what it is. But me and you could go on and discuss even further, because I might have quite a lot of questions, but I would like, since we need to be mindful of time, I would like to invite some of our listeners here on Twitter Space to join our stage and raise the hand if they want to come to ask a question or comment on what we just said. So the floor is open. And I would like to please present yourself, say your name and where you're from, which organization affiliation do you have as well, so that everyone can listen. I have now Samuel and Virendra. I would start with Samuel. Hi, Samuel.
Hi, Giuseppe. Hi, Simone. Thank you so much for the discussion. Can we ask questions, or should we wait a bit?
Yeah, that's the moment to ask questions. Yes.
Okay, I just wanted to ask Simone his opinion with regards to a natural gas being considered a transition energy, and how he views the Commission's future decisions on that, both with regards to natural gas, but also potentially with regards to coal. Will there be any exceptions in the future because of the very dire security situation vis-a-vis Russia and Ukraine today? Thanks.
Yeah, thanks. So this is, as far as energy is concerned, a fossil fuel crisis. The reason why we are in this situation is because of our over-reliance on fossil fuels. So I think that ultimately, in the medium long term, Europe will get out of this situation way greener than before. This is the baseline. So I think all these will accelerate the green transition and the implementation of the European Green Deal, because it is always has been the case historically that after an energy crisis, the fuel that doesn't benefit from that longer term is the fuel at the center of the crisis itself. Now, just to remind you that after the oil shocks in the 70s, people started to consume gas and electricity instead of oil. We started to invest into solar energy research and development. So that's a long-term trend. But in the very short term, we need to work to find substitutes, because it is clearly impossible to, you know, get entirely replace the Russian volumes with renewables, let's say, in a matter of a few years. So that's impossible. So we need to find substitutes. That will be, I think, LNG. LNG will be the predominant element in this architecture. And possibly in the very short term, should an interruption occur, coal will also make a comeback into the electricity system. I don't think this will change much, you know, all the discussion related to the taxonomy, etc. I think we will keep these conversations separated. I don't see why we should, you know, go back to that kind of conversation. Now, I think we will just focus on securing our energy systems in the short term, also recurring to dirty solutions, to be clear, but with a clear idea that we now really need to scale up green investments. We need to solve all those bureaucratic bottlenecks that are hindering renewable energy projects to be put into practice, and we really need to make sure that in a matter of 5 years, our reliance overall on fossil fuels is already significantly decreased.
Thank you, Simone. I have Velina. Velina, hi.
Hello. Great discussion. As always, I really cherish your studies, by the way. Just wanted to let you know. And I've been also using a lot of the Bruegel research while trying to somehow contribute to the discussion in Austria. So obviously we are in a dire situation, and it's a kind of a self-inflicted pain as well, because we have 150 billion cubic meters of natural gas from Russia, which obviously is not going to be replaced from one day to the next. And my particular question is, I have, as you can imagine, a lot of questions, but I would like to stick only to one, at least at the beginning of this discussion, namely, what happens if Russia decides to actually cut off the gas demand, the gas supply to Europe. If we take Austria as an example, and this is not even the best case example, but let me just use Austria as an example. We have 40% dependence on gas supply for the industry, another 20% for the households, and then we have also another 30% for this so-called gas power stations, mm-hmm. right? Which are also actually responsible for the electricity. So what happens if it's the other way around? Obviously, we will not manage in the short term to replace the gas supply, but in 2 weeks from now, let's say, or in 3 weeks from now, what will be our scenario in the case that Putin decides to put additional pressure on us, on our European decision makers, given the fact that many member states are really, in the short term, really dependent?
Mm-hmm. Thank you, Velina. And of course, likewise, I also follow your work and appreciate it. So thank you also for that. And I think your question is, of course, the nightmare of all policymakers, particularly the ones sitting in Vienna, Berlin, Rome, all those countries that in the past didn't pay too much attention to the principles of energy diversification, right? So the answer to your question, I think, will be, you know, we will have an emergency plan in which the gas will be, the consumption sector that will be prioritized will be, of course, the residential system. So our homes, keeping the homes warm, if needed, before the summer, you never know the weather. And for the cooking, etc., will be the priority number one. Then you have, in the merit order, the electricity production, where, in any case, you need to find substitutes. So opening up the old coal-fired power plants will be also necessary for that purpose. And then industry will be the sector in which, if there is a curtailment of gas, it will happen in the industry. And there you have already a list of sectors that will have to be prioritized in terms of the curtailment. Those are the energy-intensive sectors that do not provide, strategic products to our societies, let's say food, for example, or chemicals. So you need to phase down production in sectors that government will decide are not strategic. So you will have a very difficult triage to be done by governments. Some governments are already preparing these kind of plans. Italy, for example, is actively working on that. We already have certain industries, by the way, that have the so-called interruptible gas contracts with gas suppliers. So they typically get a little bit of a reduction in the price of the gas, but then they can get interrupted in case of an emergency. So we will have to prioritize. We will have to do a difficult triage of where the limited gas will have to go. And at the same time, we will have to scale up the imports of the LNG. Let me recall here that the seasonality is very important in gas markets. We are luckily going towards the spring and the summer, which means warmer temperatures and no consumption for the residential heating. But the main challenge for Europe will be to fill up the storages ahead of next winter. Rightly so, the Commission is asking all countries to fill up at least 80% of the storages by October. We made some numbers yesterday. I mean, at the current prices, this is going to be super expensive for Europe. Typically, we spent 10 billion euros for the refilling of our storages during the spring and the summer. At the current prices, we are going to spend something like 60-70 billion euros for that exercise. So this is going to be super expensive, of course, but we will have to do that, and we will have to do that at due time, because what we cannot really afford is to start next winter without the storages full. If we are in that position in October, then Europe really is in trouble. So now the existential challenge is to fill up the storages during the good season so that we can start the new winter in October in a more confident position. If we fail to do that, then we really are at systemic risk. which I mean blackouts, etc.
Thank you, Simone. Very important points, obviously. I have to be mindful of time, but I still would like to take another question or remark from one of our listeners. I have in my list Catherine Schreier. Hi, Catherine. How are you? Can you introduce yourself, please?
Hi, sure. Catherine Schreier. I'm from. I'm a journalist in Berlin writing a story for Al Jazeera. So I'm ready to ask a question. Europe and Germany in particular isn't doing enough to stop importing Russian fuels. At the same time, we've had our economy minister, Robert Habeck, he recently explained, you know, that if we cut off energies, we are harming ourselves more than Russia. A weaker Germany obviously means a weaker Europe. So looking at the bigger picture, if we go a few steps further, we ban coal, we put tariffs on oil and gas, one assumes we then see inflation, possibly job losses, then we have knock-on effects in low-income countries. It sounds terrible. Do you see the big picture as a big problem, or is this the least worst choice?
Yeah. So, of course, there are several now estimations about the economic implication of a full energy embargo on Russian energy. These studies, both done for Germany, but also now more recently for Europe, point to a potential impact that ranges between 1% of GDP and 5% of GDP. So these wouldn't be an impact of the sort of, you know, the order of magnitude of the pandemic, but still a very significant impact. And of course, the these implications have to also take into consideration higher inflation, etc. You are perfectly right to point to the fact of this, to the point of the second round effects. What happens in Europe doesn't stay in Europe. Europe is such a large market that, of course, whatever happens here will then reverberate in global energy markets. So what you will see is that if Europe needs to import massive amounts of LNG, then countries like Pakistan, for example, Bangladesh and others that need LNG will not be able to pay for that. And that's exactly the reason why, as mentioned before, international coordination will be of paramount importance in such a scenario, because at that point, the problem will not be a European problem anymore, will be a global problem. And the more we are able to coordinate this scenario internationally, the better, because we really need to be aware of the second round effects on developing countries in particular. But for the direct implications for Europe of a full embargo, well, I think that's the ultimate question. How much is it worth it for Europe to punish, you know, an aggression of the sort we are seeing every day? That's the ultimate question. How willing are we to pay ourselves to seriously punish a country that does what we see every day? So that's the fundamental question. I think the momentum is growing to say, well, we need to be ready to pay our price in order to go down that way and really punish them for what has been done and is being done, unfortunately, in Ukraine.
Thank you.
Thank you, Catherine. Thank you to everyone. Unfortunately, I know we could go on and discuss for much longer, but unfortunately, our time for this Twitter space and for our recording of our Sound of Economics live podcast is coming to an end. So I would really like to thank everyone joining this episode. We are going to continue at Bruegel to cover with our analysis various aspects of the economic fallout of the war in Ukraine. So stay tuned with the Sound of Economics, as well as check the previous episodes of our podcast on our website and the overall coverage we are doing of the war in Ukraine as it unfolds. Our website is www.bruegel.org. Thanks a lot, Simone. Thanks a lot, everyone that joined the Twitter space, and to all our listeners of The Sound of Economics. Until next time, bye-bye.